From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Jill Kirk-Conway grew up on a remote sheep station in the Australian outback and later became the president of Smith College. Her coming-of-age memoir, The Road from Corain, was a bestseller. On this edition of Fresh Air, Conway continues her story. She tells us about organizing for women's rights on campus and creating a marriage in which she and her husband are equal partners. Also, we talk with Dr. Jonathan Mann, the former director of the World Health Organization's AIDS program, now directs a center on health and human rights. And Maureen Corrigan has a review of Shelter, the new novel by Jane Ann Phillips. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Secret Service says a Maryland man with a history of mental illness stole a light plane and crashed it early this morning on the White House lawn. The plane sliced through a magnolia tree and slammed into the side of the presidential mansion, killing pilot Frank Corder. President Clinton and his family weren't at the mansion, which is having minor repair work done. Secret Service spokesman Carl Meyer says the incident doesn't seem to be directed at the president. It's been unclear how the plane could get so close to the presidential mansion without being seen. Meyer says there are a couple of ways.
An aircraft, if it doesn't have a transponder turned on, that's one type of tracking for it. There's another one that picks it up at a certain altitude. Somebody coming in at treetop with a transponder turned off, it's very likely that they're not going to be detected by FAA.
Indications are the plane was that low, sir?
It sounds like it was when it turned around from the witness accounts, and I don't know this firsthand, that it was coming in almost at treetop.
Meyer says there were no bombs or weapons aboard Corder's plane. Relatives say the pilot was distraught over the death of his father and the recent breakup of his marriage. The National Labor Relations Board is awarding National Football League players a record $30 million in back pay. The award stems from the 24-day football strike in 1987. The NLRB says the money is the largest back pay award in the history of the agency. The Football Players Association had brought charges against the football owners seeking lost wages and bonuses. The NFL Management Council had refused to let the players play in games on the weekend of October 18th and 19th of 1987, when the players had unconditionally already ended the walkout. Jeb Bush, former President George Bush's son, has secured the Republican nomination for the Florida gubernatorial race. NPR's Derek Reveron reports.
Jeb Bush's only remaining opponent dropped out of the gubernatorial race today, clearing the way for him to take on Democratic Governor Lawton Chiles in November. Last week, Bush defeated six opponents in the Republican primary with 46% of the vote. But Bush faced a runoff next month against Florida Secretary of State Jim Smith. However, Smith quit the race today, saying that a runoff could split Florida's Republican Party and hurt its chances of defeating Governor Chiles. Bush is expected to mount a strong challenge to Chiles, aided by his father, George Bush. The former president has helped his son raise money and is expected to campaign for him this fall. I'm Derek Reveron reporting.
Hundreds of people are waiting around U.S. government offices in Havana, Cuba. They're trying to find out how they can seek a visa under the new U.S.-Cuban immigration deal. But a spokesman for the Cuban Interior Ministry says the details are still being worked out. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has fallen about 14 points to 3861. This is NPR. Japan's fragile coalition government suffered a humiliating defeat at the polls yesterday. Voters chose an opposition candidate in a special upper-class, or rather upper-house, election. NPR's Julie McCarthy reports from Tokyo.
The defeat in the Aichi district was the first measure of popularity for Prime Minister Murayama's 10-week-old government, an unusual marriage between the Socialist Party and the conservative LDP. From its inception, this coalition of former foes drew criticism as a shameless maneuver for power. And yesterday's voters didn't seem to like it much either. In balloting to fill a vacant seat in the upper house of the Japanese parliament, or Diet, the voters handed an easy victory to a political newcomer backed by a group of increasingly powerful reformers. The win gives a boost to attempts by the 10 parties in opposition to unite under one new party. And while the Murayama government is not in immediate danger of falling, Sunday's loss diminishes its already weak standing. I'm Julie McCarthy in Tokyo.
A Ford Motor Company worker accused of shooting co-workers to death and wounding two others has been jailed without bond. Oliver French didn't enter a plea at his arraignment today in Dearborn, Michigan. He is charged with two counts of first-degree murder and two counts of intent to murder and a felony firearms charge. French is charged in the weekend shootings during a union meeting at the Ford Rouge plant in Dearborn. United Auto Workers officials say French had become bitter over the ouster of a union caucus that he had supported. The officials working on the crash site of U.S. Air Flight 427 say the recovery of the victims may take several more days. The recovery effort has been difficult. Conditions are tough. Rain has left the rugged terrain dangerously slippery. The American Red Cross has brought in a stress specialist to help workers who are emotionally drained. Investigators hope to take some of the wreckage to a hangar today, and they'll try to reassemble parts of it. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Perhaps you already know the story of the first part of Jill Kirkconway's life, before she became the first woman president of Smith College. It was the subject of her best-selling memoir, The Road from Corain. It told about her childhood on a remote sheep station, which her parents ran in the Australian outback, where she was physically and intellectually cut off from the world. Her new memoir, True North, tells what happens after she set off for Harvard alone, leaving behind what she describes as her suffocating family and a culture actively hostile to aspiring women. For the first time in her life, she found friends she could talk to without censoring her words or her emotions. She found her niche as a scholar of women's history. And she found, to her surprise, that she fell in love with John Conway, the historian with whom she was working as a teaching fellow. They decided to get married, even though she had always thought that marriage would be the wrong choice for her.
I was such an anomalous person in my native Australia, and I think it would have been very difficult for me to fit into a conventional Australian marriage. John Conway was already a professional scholar. He wasn't somebody who wanted a wife to make a comfortable domestic environment for him. He wanted a partner in sort of major intellectual tasks, and that was a relationship that I thought I could handle. I wasn't absolutely certain that I could ever settle into being the helping wife who's always typing her husband's manuscripts and managing somehow or another to create the right environment for somebody else to blossom in.
Early on into your marriage, you realized that you both had a lot of mood swings. You had always had depressions, and you realized he had very serious depressions too. And you write about during some of those depressions, he'd become almost unrecognizable. Quote, as though a stranger had replaced my sensitive and loving husband with someone obsessed by demons of rage, tormented by suspicion. It must have been very unsettling, especially early on, when you saw changes like that and wondered, you know, who he was becoming.
Well, you know, I had grown up with a neurotic family, and the thing that I think that gave me was the capacity to live through other people's moods and keep my own balance. I wouldn't recommend that as a good training for anyone, but it turned out to stand me in very good stead. And my husband was so open and direct about facing the problems he had to deal with very deep mood swings, that when he came out of them, we would always be able to analyze what had happened. And I gradually learned that at those points, I just had to wait for him to reappear as his usual positive and constructive self. You know, we all managed to live with somebody with acute physical ailments, and those problems of emotional swings are no different.
Early on, before you fully comprehended his condition, did you ever take it personally that somehow your relationship wasn't enough to make him happy all the time?
Oh, well, you know, every young person thinks that they will be absolutely the cure of everything that has ever troubled their partner in life. And I think it's part of growing up and maturing to realize that many problems are insoluble, and that one can help but never resolve them.
He had shock treatments during one bout of depression. What were the effects of that?
Well, I think that is, as I say in the book, I think of electric shock therapy as the ultimate example of the engineering mentality and the sort of idea of the technological fix. Nobody knew then, and they still don't know, why passing a current through the brain should have the effect of jolting people out of terrible depression. And the argument is often made that that is better than experiencing the depression. I think that's absolutely fallacious. It damages people's memory irrevocably. And for someone who is a professional scholar, it had a devastating effect because a lifetime of learning was lost. He couldn't recall it.
Did he lose that memory permanently?
Not permanently, but for a very substantial period of time.
Like years or?
Yes. Oh, yes, indeed.
Well, that must have been terrifying to both of you.
It certainly was. And one of the motivations that prompted me to write about that experience was the hope that it would deter other people from having that kind of therapy. It's becoming popular again, especially used for poor people, because it's hard to monitor treatment for their depressions, which requires monitoring blood levels of a drug and so forth. So it's a therapy that's creeping back into popularity, and I think it's a dreadful one.
Did all of his memory eventually come back?
No, I don't think anybody's memory is ever as good again. Many people lose short-term recall and have quite excellent long-term memory. Others have whole periods of their life disappear.
When you were at the University of Toronto, you became something of an activist. You started organizing women on campus around women's issues, such as equal pay. You went in and basically demanded to know why you weren't being given a promotion.
Yes, that's right. My experience fits exactly with the social science textbooks. Women are supposed to experience their first serious discrimination 7 years after initial employment, and mine came in 6.5 years, so I was right on schedule. And when I did call a meeting of women faculty at the university, I discovered that it wasn't just a question of discrimination in pay within rank, but very differential rates of promotion and access to research support and so forth.
Well, you went on to be appointed the first woman vice president at the University of Toronto, but after you got that position, you figured you were probably a disappointment to the feminist proponents of women's studies on campus. Why did you oppose women's studies programs?
Well, it's a basic difference in strategy and what one thinks will be an effective mechanism for changing institutions. I thought that the most important thing was to transform the program of instruction of conventional departments and schools. I mean, I wanted the law school to study the legal treatment of domestic violence, or the School of Architecture to study transportation and how the way it's scheduled in a city affects how women can move around. You know, just when poor mothers need to collect their children from school is just when the bus schedule is at its least helpful and so forth. Or I wanted the medical school to spend more time researching heart disease in women. We didn't know about the frequency of breast cancer back in those days. And I thought those things were as important for the university to become committed to as creating a separate academic program which would study women's experience in a cross-disciplinary way. I believed that working in those professional schools might have more immediate impact on the lives of a great many women.
Well, how do you think women's studies programs have worked out?
Well, I think they have transformed a number of disciplines, literary studies particularly, the whole area of cultural criticism, but the ability to translate that knowledge into what a lawyer learns or how a doctor is trained has not been a core issue for those programs. And I hope someday we'll be able to link them up in some way.
My guest is Jill Kerr-Conway. She was the first woman president of Smith College. She's written her second memoir called True North. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Jill Kerr-Conway. One of the things that a lot of professional women have had to deal with is balancing being a mother and being a professional. You weren't able to have children. You had hoped to have children, but a medical problem prevented that. And I wonder how you coped with that at different stages of your life.
Well, I found it a most absolutely devastating experience at the time. But, you know, another part of growing up in life is learning that not everything is always going to work out the way you hoped it would, and that one has to adjust and find the creative response to whatever constraints you experience in life. That was something I had to do about not having my own biological family. We simply acquired a surrogate family of many other young people who were not our biological children.
It seems like so many things that happened to you in your life just led you to become more and more independent.
Well, I suppose that's one way of...
becoming independent, right?
Yes.
Your memoir ends as you become the president of Smith, so I think I'll save our discussion of what happened with you at Smith College for what I imagine will be the subject of your next memoir.
One day,
right. Yeah. So, but I want to talk some more about how you planned a relationship of equality with your husband. I'm talking, for instance, about how you decided to divide up your money. I mean, you had an arrangement plan for that, at least early on in the marriage. You want to describe that?
Yes, you know, it's always interested me. So many families where there were young children and a very highly educated wife would say to me, oh, Janie can't afford to work. By the time we replaced her work in the house and bought the clothes that she'll need to have a professional life... she won't be earning any money. And I was always fascinated that it was assumed that the woman alone was responsible for replacing her domestic labor. My husband and I made an agreement early in our married life that we would figure out what it cost us to run our household, including the domestic help, and then we would each contribute to that household budget proportionately to what we earned. So my husband was supporting far more of the cost of replacing my domestic labor than I was. And we each had our own disposable income after that to do whatever we wanted with.
Now, what was the logic in your relationship of keeping your income separate as opposed to just putting it in one big joint account?
We both felt very strongly that we should be able to plan... anything that related to our professional lives, travel, even vacations, using our own resources. The fact that we were married and shared a common dwelling and a partnership in life didn't mean that we ceased to be individuals in other ways.
Did that continue to work for you?
It always has.
So you're still doing
blendedly,
it that way?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yes, indeed.
Well, now, let me ask you this. When you had a bestseller, and mm-hmm. I imagine you made a fair amount of money, Did you feel guilty keeping most of that in your account and not, you know, splitting it up or anything?
Not at all. I mean, it's always been part of our married life that what you earn outside what's required to maintain your joint household is yours.
Now, something else that a lot of people find very intriguing, such as myself, is that you had this, like, 10-year plan with your husband. Explain how that works.
Well, we agreed very early on that every 10 years the other person would get to say where you lived, so that one person's career would always be primary, but we would take turns. We didn't want to have a commuting marriage, which was the other solution people tried to adopt. But we both really cherished the experience of living together, didn't like being parted, and so we solved the problem that way. And we have been married for a little more than 30 years now, and we're just coming up to the beginning of another 10-year period of mine. I'm thinking about what we're going to do.
So does this mean you have to move? I mean, can you just say, let's stay where we are this time?
If you like what you're doing, you can stay where you are.
Uh-huh. So I guess it's premature to ask you to share what your thoughts are.
I can't tell you because I haven't got there yet.
Right. And so living in Boston was your husband's pick?
Yes, that's right. It was the beginning of his retirement. He's 18 years older than I. And he wanted to be in the city where most of his professional peers were retiring and where he was close to his own generation. He also had some health problems that meant he wanted to be somewhere where he was comfortable with all the medical resources that were available. And we both love the city. And it's within reach of our cherished place in the country in Western Massachusetts. So it was a good place for the 10 years.
Now, here's the rough part. Say you decide that in your heart of hearts you'd really like to move, and that would mean taking your husband away from his circle of retired friends and away from the medical support system that he has. How hard would it be for you to do that, even though fair is fair, it's your 10 years?
Oh, we've already been talking about it. I mean, he's perfectly prepared for that.
Mm-hmm. Your husband's 18 years older, and I think that 18 years is a lot bigger a gap as you get older, and I'm wondering if that's been affecting the relationship at all, or if that's something that's been weighing on you at all as you watch your husband get older.
If you live with somebody who's almost a generation older than you, it can work in two ways. That difference can be stressed, or it can be very easily bridged. My husband is chronologically 18 years older than I am, but in a lot of ways, he's psychologically a good deal younger. He's much more naive and in many ways much more open to experience and much more spontaneous. So that, in fact, his chronological age is a lot more advanced than his psychological age, and I'm the reverse. So he's a very youthful 78-year-old, and I'm probably quite a mature 60-year-old. I can imagine that it would be very difficult living with someone whose energies were really terribly depleted and obviously declining, so that one's life experience became very different. But I think it's really very interesting to live very close to somebody who's having to struggle to come to terms with the issues of their own mortality and so forth, a valuable experience, which I'm glad to have had.
But you must worry about losing him.
Of course I do. Everybody should be worried about that every day of their life, though. I mean, we all live poised on the brink of eternity.
I want to ask you about writing memoirs. You've not only written two memoirs of your own, but you've written about other women's memoirs. I mean, even your thesis was about women's memoirs.
Yes.
You know, there's that whole idea that the writer is ultimately a traitor, that if you're writing personally, you're betraying the people who are closest to you because you're writing about them too.
Yeah.
And I'd love to know how far you feel comfortable going in your own memoirs when it comes to the lives of other people. Your mother, who you write about all the problems you've had, and...
Well, I don't think my mother is diminished by depicting the tragedy of her life, because I start out in The Road from Karain showing people this absolutely wonderfully powerful, rich, joyful, creative woman, and to chronicle her deterioration as a result of a society that had no place for an older woman and taught a widow to think of her life as over doesn't seem to me to diminish her. It just really emphasizes the tragedy of her life. Other people who are living, I always show what I've written about them. And if they don't like it or didn't, I would either leave it out or change it or find some other way to say what I wanted to say. In fact, nobody has ever asked me to change anything.
You must really believe in the memoir as an important form.
Yes, I do. I think that it is, in many ways, the form of narrative that is most gripping to contemporary readers. I think we read it the way 19th century people read Dickens or Hardy or somebody like that. And I think it's because it's in writing memoirs that we are obliged to say what the total constellation of all our roles means to us. And that's the real dilemma of the modern consciousness. We have a sense of an inner core of being, which is us, which looks out and comments on life and experience, and which is part of but not subsumed by all the roles that we play. I think modern moral philosophers think that you really can't judge a life without looking at the total sum of all the roles that are intertwined within it and trying to interpret what they all add up to. And I think that's the aspect of the modern consciousness that really resonates when we read a memoir. We want to see somebody else telling us what it's all added up to because we want to be able to do that for ourselves.
Have there been any liabilities for you to become a more public person, which is what you've become since writing your memoirs?
Well, no, I think an obsession with privacy for women is a bourgeois hang-up.
Do you really?
Men don't feel obliged to keep their public lives secret, and they talk about their private lives whenever they think they're relevant. And all that the obsession with privacy does is prevent women from sharing their experience with other people. And ever since I've been married, my husband and I have lived in a public residence of some sort. As president of Smith College, I had 45,000 alumni friends who were interested in every aspect of my personal life, and I found it didn't bother me at all.
No, that's very interesting, because I think a lot of women and a lot of men in positions of authority, like you were as the head of a college, would try very hard to not let the people who they work with know a lot of personal things about them. I mean, for a lot of people, that's a strategy for maintaining a certain dignity and respect and power within an organization.
Well, you know, if you tell the story of your life, it is no more fanciful and no more interesting to people than all the fantasies they have about you. So you might just as well have your say on the record, too.
Jill Kirk-Conway, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure.
Jill Kirk-Conway's new memoir is True North. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Dr. Jonathan Mann learned the scope of the AIDS epidemic in his work directing the World Health Organization's Global AIDS Program. He concluded that the virus gravitated toward the most marginalized parts of society, where women have no reproductive rights and where there is little education. Now he's applied what he's learned to set up a Center for Health and Human Rights, which is about to hold its first international conference. Coming up, Dr. Mann talks with us about making the connection between health and human rights. Also, Maureen Corrigan reviews Shelter, Jane Ann Phillips' dark novel about a girl's summer camp. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Many delegates at the UN Population Conference in Cairo have argued that improving women's rights is an essential step to controlling population growth. Dr. Jonathan Mann is an epidemiologist who's exploring the connection between human rights and health. He's the founding director of a new Center for Health and Human Rights at the Harvard School of Public Health. Next week, the center hosts the first international conference on health and human rights. Dr. Mann was the founding director of the World Health Organization's Global AIDS Program, and he chaired the 1992 International Conference on AIDS. He says that human rights is a precondition of health.
My own understanding of this came through AIDS. I had done a lot of work in AIDS over the last decade, and it became increasingly obvious to me that there was more to what we needed to do to deal with AIDS than just distributing condoms, providing information, providing counseling and support, and educational programs and so forth. There was something missing. And the key discovery for me was in Uganda. And a group of women lawyers in Uganda essentially explained to me that they understood that women in Uganda couldn't refuse unprotected or unwanted sexual intercourse by their husband, even if they knew their husband was infected with AIDS, because they didn't have the social status or the rights to be able to say no. In other words, very concretely, if they said no, they would either be beaten and they had no legal recourse, or they could be divorced entirely at the decision of the husband, and divorce in those societies would result essentially in civil and economic death. There'd be no property for the woman. She would be deprived of status. It's a form of death. So, in essence, the women lawyers group in Uganda decided in order to protect women against AIDS, their rights had to be protected. And so they've initiated the process of changing the laws governing property distribution after divorce as an anti-AIDS strategy. That really made concrete for me this linkage that allows a person to achieve a state of health or to protect their health when and if their rights are protected.
Do you think there are other epidemics besides AIDS? I remember the last time we spoke, you said that the AIDS virus has a way of gravitating toward the most marginalized portions of society.
Right.
Because the poorer somebody is, the more without information they are, the more without mm-hmm. rights they are,
right.
the more likely they are to not know about the spread of AIDS or to not have the power to control their own decisions and making sure
Absolutely.
That they don't get it. So is this true of other epidemics too, do you think, of other viruses and other bacteria, that they gravitate to the marginalized portions of society?
It is. It's true if one looks at the history of diseases, both infectious diseases and chronic diseases. Initially, at the beginning of a major worldwide epidemic, say of a new virus or of a newly emerging virus, rather, it's possible for quite privileged sections of a society to be affected initially. Look at the situation, for example, in the United States or in certain African countries. In some African countries, the AIDS epidemic appears to have started among the highly mobile urban elite that was able to travel, in a sense, get infected, and then come home with the virus. But give that society 10 years, give that virus 10 years in that society, and it will gravitate, just as you suggested and as we discussed earlier, towards the marginalized, the dispossessed, the poor, and those who are deprived by society of their rights and or their dignity. That's a general pattern, and it's as true of many cancers as it is true of heart disease, as it is true of injuries. Take the problem of, you know, injuries, and I mean by that what we used to call accidents, except the word accident implies that it kind of comes out of the blue and is unpredictable, whereas in fact, injuries are relatively predictable, and they do not occur homogeneously throughout a society. Certain groups in society are more at risk, more vulnerable to injuries than others, whether it's automobile injuries or injuries in the home or fires or drownings or whatever. And if you just look at the patterns, you see a clear distinction. And we claim that that distinction can best be described by doing a rights analysis. Those who are in most possession of their rights and dignity are least vulnerable. Those in least possession of their rights and dignity, deprived of their rights and dignity, are most vulnerable.
I'd like you to talk a little bit about how the current approach to public health internationally compares to what you would like to see it become.
Yeah, well, that's very much the focus of our work and what we're about. Public health has generally been pretty modest, at least in recent years, in its approaches and its claims. For example, with AIDS, if we look at AIDS prevention, the international strategy, the global strategy against AIDS, which I and colleagues developed when I was at the World Health Organization in Geneva, essentially involves an effort to provide people with information, with certain services, in the interest of helping them make decisions for themselves about their behavior, because behavior is, of course, at the root of HIV transmission, particularly sexual behavior. But we realized something much deeper once we got further into the problem of AIDS and its prevention, and we learned in part from our failures, from the fact that the AIDS epidemic is intensifying worldwide at the same time that the programs that we called for are multiplying and exist in many places. That paradox led us to ask what's missing. And this is what's missing in public health more broadly. What's missing is this broader understanding of the societal dimensions of health. We often think of health, we may, as individuals, think of health as something that involves our genetics, and then from there on pretty much involves things that we have control over. I use the example of the Ugandan woman married to a man with AIDS as just one illustration of the ways in which what look like choices are not real choices. And in fact, our, quote, choice has been determined by a societal context. That level of understanding of the way in which the way society creates conditions in which people can either be healthy or unhealthy helps us understand, Terry, why in the United States, the health of the black population, the health of the Latino or Hispanic population is not as good as the health of the white population. It helps us understand issues of women's discrimination against women worldwide and the relationship of that discrimination to health status. So public health of the future has to not only continue to use the normal tools of public health that have been developed traditionally, but has to address the roots of the problem itself, the roots of AIDS, the roots of problems in health like cancer and heart disease and injuries and violence. And those roots are societal, and we have to address them societally. We think that the human rights perspective will give a coherent strategy to this effort to influence society in directions so that people can be healthy.
So who do you have to convince? You have to convince epidemiologists, doctors, human rights workers, governments?
What we're trying to do most of all is build bridges between health workers and human rights workers, because we see a commonality of interest and a commonality of action. We want that to develop. For that to develop, they have these two groups, the health workers and the human rights workers, have to learn how to talk to each other. And that's one of the main reasons we've organized the conference next week, the first international conference on health and human rights, to create kind of a bridge between these two communities who speak really rather different languages at first glance.
What's the difference between those languages?
Well, you know, most public health, unfortunately, still takes place in the biomedical language. That is the language of morbidity and mortality and physical causes of disease or disability or premature death. Most of the people working in health are physicians or have medical type training. On the other side, most human rights workers either are lawyers or have legal training or are come from grassroots organizations with an activist community organizing kind of environment. And these groups of people speak really different languages, and it takes time and some patience for us to hear each other. Once we do hear each other, we then can be at the point where we can begin to say things like this. If we're going to fight AIDS successfully in this country, we're going to have to deal more successfully with issues, for example, of racism and homophobia. Now, can health workers stop by just saying that, or do health workers have to, having recognized these as roots of the problem, do health workers now have to work with rights people to try to correct the conditions, ameliorate the conditions, that in fact lead to the health problem in the first place?
My guest is epidemiologist Dr. Jonathan Mann. He directs the Center for Health and Human Rights at the Harvard School of Public Health. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about health and human rights with Dr. Jonathan Mann. You've said that it was your work with AIDS that made you realize how important the connection between health and human rights is. Do you think that the international AIDS community is actually making that connection and how they're approaching the epidemic?
Actually, paradoxically, and I can speak from the experience recently of being at the Yokohama AIDS conference last month, paradoxically, at the higher levels, so to speak, that is, at the level of the United Nations, the World Health Organization, I don't think they're getting it. However, at the level of the grassroots organizations, at the level of the people and at the field level, not only do they get it, but they're the ones who are really advancing the field more than those of us that, you know, that sit in what are sometimes called ivory towers, although I don't think in this case that would apply. Still, the real creativity occurs when people face concrete problems concretely in the field. So there are groups working against discrimination, against homosexuals, against sex workers, against women, against adolescents. There are groups that are seeing that when you increase the educational status in a community and when you increase opportunity for better jobs, you create a situation in which the vulnerability to AIDS will decrease. You know, it was said very early in the AIDS epidemic in this country that if you want a young African-American man in the inner city to wear a condom, you need to start by giving him a future. That kind of insight has been grasped at the grassroots level, but I'm afraid at the international level, at the official level, this is probably too threatening, frankly, to the status quo to be undertaken in any official way. Instead, what you see are the words human rights sort of plastered here and there on declarations, but without any content.
You're going to be bringing together human rights workers and doctors at your conference next week. Do you feel like somebody who's bringing together two different sides of the family who haven't met yet, you know, or introducing one set of friends to another set of friends and you're not sure how well they're going to get along?
Well, I'd say it's like introducing two sets of friends and being pretty sure they're going to hit it off just fine, but maybe still being a little bit nervous that that they might not understand, you know, they might rub each other the wrong way somehow. I really think that you know, the time is ripe, and the movement of understanding about the relationship between health and human rights that has grown so rapidly through the AIDS experience that brought a lot of us, to speak for myself. I mean, I knew nothing about human rights and was really completely ignorant about rights all through medical school and school of public health and my work until in AIDS I found some things, discovered with the help of other people, some things that have changed my whole approach and attitude towards public health and towards what we need to do. So this isn't for everybody. I don't pretend that all physicians are going to jump on this bandwagon and say this is great. And I don't think all human rights workers are going to be excited about working with health people, partially because health people often have a sort of a bad rep. I mean, a sort of reputation of being just very narrow, biomedical, and wanting to control. So there are real issues there, no question about it. But like any good family or like any good group of friends, with a couple of days, a couple of dinners, and the chance to talk to each other and listen, I'm confident of the outcome.
What are some of the discussions you're most looking forward to?
Well, the range is really extraordinary. I think, for example, on environmental health and the right to a healthy environment, this is really, I think, a really critical area for us. Another area has to do with indigenous peoples and their rights and health. A lot has been discovered recently, but we want to hear more about the ways in which race, class, and gender discrimination occur in healthcare itself, which I think is really an important issue.
Do you have a lot of people telling you you're naive?
That's not new. When I started the work on AIDS at the World Health Organization, people said, you can't do that work at WHO. WHO is just a big bureaucracy. But we did a lot of things that surprised WHO. And by the way, when I left WHO in 1990, when I resigned, I was told in sort of, angry words by the director general that I should never forget that AIDS is a health problem, not a human rights problem. And I'm pleased to report to you that now the AIDS program at WHO has a human rights section and that WHO itself is creating a health and human rights program of its own. Dynamite.
Do health policies ever have a bad effect on human rights?
They can. I think that we've seen clear examples, again, in AIDS and other areas, where health people will kind of react in a knee-jerk way to a situation. Mm-hmm. And they'll say, okay, we have a situation here. We need to, take these people, test them. We don't care whether they agree or not. And if they're infected, we're going to do this or that to them. These are all potentially very violating of human rights kinds of approaches. And a part of the work of our center is really to try to help educate health workers about rights, because only when they understand rights do they understand how they can achieve the health goals at minimal cost to rights. At the Harvard School of Public Health for the last 4 years, every graduate gets two scrolls. One is the diploma that they earned, and the other is a copy of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights for them to frame, because we believe that the Declaration of Human Rights is as important to their work in public health as the Hippocratic Oath would be for a physician.
Well, Dr. Mann, I thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Jonathan Mann directs the Center for Health and Human Rights at the Harvard School of Public Health. Their International Conference on Health and Human Rights begins September 22nd at Harvard. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what do you have on that plane that crashed right near the White House?
Well, we have Mara Liasson and a number of other people looking into what the plane was doing there and what the Secret Service is doing about that kind of emergency. We also are talking to to some people in the National Service Corps. That starts this week, and apparently there are many more applicants than there are places in this new Service Corps created by President Clinton. We'll also take a quick look at politics, the Minnesota governor's race, and the Senate races, which nominations will be decided in primaries tomorrow.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. It's been 10 years since writer Jane Ann Phillips dazzled critics and readers with her first novel, Machine Dreams. Her new novel, Shelter, is a dark parable about a group of emotionally wounded children at a Girl Guides camp in West Virginia. Critic Maureen Corrigan says Shelter was worth waiting for.
My only experience with summer camp was the year I worked as a counselor at an Orthodox Jewish camp in the Catskills. The camp, which was on the verge of bankruptcy, had received a grant to host deaf, Black, and Hispanic children from the inner city. For me, that summer was an excursion into the pitfalls of multiculturalism. At mealtimes, the cook, still working from a kosher menu plan, would serve up kasha, bananas and cream, and brisket-like mystery meat. The kids wouldn't eat this strange food, and since I didn't know sign language, I couldn't persuade them to. They mostly lived on peanut butter cookies. I developed a taste for potato kugel. At first, the camp in Jane Ann Phillips' novel, Shelter, looks a lot more like the well-organized, arts and craftsy kinds of summer camps my friends sentimentally remember. but Philip slowly transforms her bucolic campsite into a battleground, set for a deadly face-off between the cosmic forces of good and evil. The food is the least of the hardships the kids in Philip's camp will have to endure. Shelter opens in July of 1963 and concludes in November, right before the Kennedy assassination. Phillips clearly intends for her golden summer story to be tinged with the chill air of approaching tragedy. Camp Shelter, as it's ironically called, is run by a loony director who forces her campers to watch anti-communist propaganda films. Cold War paranoia also infiltrates the relationships among the chief characters here. Everybody is spying on everybody else. There are secrets and betrayals. 8-year-old Alma, for instance, knows her mother and her best friend Delia's father had an affair. Everyone but Delia seems to know that her father, who died 4 months ago, committed suicide. From outside the camp, a pair of misfits observes the girls closely. There's an ex-con named Carmody and a man simply called Parson, who's one of those Old Testament-type avenging angel figures only Flannery O'Connor could make believable. But Parson is the only false note here. Phillips builds her novel primarily out of the voices of children, and she brilliantly captures their distinct view of things. Delia, who's haunted by the loss of her father, has started sleepwalking. The counselors are stymied, but Alma has a canny diagnosis of her friend's restlessness. Alma thought Delia was tired because she had to try so hard not to think. When she was asleep, Delia couldn't try anymore. By far the most compelling child narrator is Buddy, the cook's 8-year-old son. Buddy's thoughts are impossible to quote because his mind is like the Sargasso Sea. Everybody else's stray comments and drifting fantasies get lodged in his head. Buddy reminds me of those cheery, pathetic children Dickens so masterfully manipulates his readers with. In the harrowing climax of Shelter, Buddy, along with some of the campers, confronts the sadistic Carmody. "I haven't been this nervous for the safety of a fictional child since Dickens' Pip grappled with the convict Magwitch in a lonely graveyard late at night."
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed Shelter by Jane Ann Phillips. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Technical direction from Wojciech Oblidis. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Barbara Bush. The former First Lady has just written her memoirs. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.